There's still one race from last month's election in which a winner hasn't been officially declared, but that should change soon. I'm Mark Brody on today's Here and Now, the recount in Arizona's 2nd Congressional District. Also, Tempe plans to add another element to its transit system. We'll find out how much it'll cost and how it may be different than what's already there. The country as a whole has recovered all the jobs it lost during the Great Recession, but the same cannot be said for Arizona. I'll talk to an economist about how the state's economy is doing, how it might do next year, and why he thinks there's a bit of a paradox. Arizona has one of the biggest populations of young people not working and not in school in the country. We'll look at two different approaches to dealing with the problem. That and more ahead on KJZZ's Here and Now after a check of this hour's news. Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, sitting in this week for Steve Goldstein. Later this hour, a look at the state's economy and predictions for how it'll do next year. And Tempe wants input from residents on its new transit project. But first, politics. Yes, still. Arizona Secretary of State Ken Bennett, along with other elected officials, issued the official canvass of the 2014 election results on Monday. In most years, that puts an end to the campaign season, but this is not most years, and in one race, the canvass appears to be just another step in the campaign. That race is for Congress in Southern Arizona's 2nd District between Democratic incumbent Ron Barber and Republican challenger Martha McSally. The results show McSally with a lead of 161 votes. One of the contested issues in that race has been over uncounted provisional ballots. John Sherman, a staff attorney at the D.C.-based Fair Elections Legal Network, has written and testified about this issue. John, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this issue of provisional ballots is something that you've thought about and written about a lot. And it seems that this is pretty consistently an issue in Arizona, yes?
Yeah, in the last couple general elections, Arizona's had thousands of provisional ballots rejected in the state because they were cast in the wrong precinct. Poll workers are in the best position to direct voters to the correct precinct, but mistakes are made. Polling places change frequently, and a provisional ballot is a fail-safe to ensure a voter can actually cast a ballot in the election if their name doesn't appear on the rolls. But, you know, in 2012, nearly 11,000 provisional ballots were rejected because they were in the wrong precinct.
So is there something that Arizona could do about this, maybe something other states have done?
Definitely. 15 states have created what I call a partial counting rule. Arizona rejects the ballot in full, meaning president down to city council and school board votes, all of those are thrown out if you're in the wrong precinct. In those 15 states, like Georgia, Illinois, New Mexico, Kansas, there are others, they will count whatever votes on the ballot you were eligible to cast if you were in the correct precinct. And that makes a great deal of sense, because if you were in the wrong precinct, but you were still in the right congressional district or legislative district, your vote should count for those races. And particularly for anything that's statewide, like a governor's race or the president of the United States, your vote should count.
At what point does a voter sort of have to take maybe a little bit more responsibility and really find out where they're supposed to be and, you know, really know what a provisional ballot is, and if they're being offered to cast one, maybe say, you know what, let me go to the right precinct and vote where I'm supposed to be?
The voter definitely has some responsibility here, obviously, to check online, look up the registration, see what precinct they're in. Often enough, as we've seen in this Arizona congressional district race, the 2nd congressional district, poll workers make mistakes. They're human. They tell voters that they're in the right place when they're not, or they give out a provisional ballot when it would have been just as easy to direct them to the correct polling place. This happened in a number of cases. They say that they've been able to reduce the number of provisional ballots that have been cast in the wrong precinct this time around by the use of electronic poll books, but it's not a stopgap. And, you know, at the end of the day, putting in a partial counting rule would ensure that voters get to vote in statewide and federal races, even if by accident or the poll worker's error, they wind up in the wrong precinct.
Do you have reason to believe that Arizona will change the way it handles provisional ballots and maybe do a partial counting system?
So So we've worked on this in the past. There was legislation introduced in the last session. It didn't move. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to propose and introduce legislation this coming cycle, that my organization, the Fair Elections Legal Network, will be working towards that goal. Whether it'll move, I don't know. But it's been a significant blemish on Arizona's record for a long time now. And the state has led in a whole variety of other areas. They were the first in the nation to adopt online voter registration, and that's spread like wildfire across the country. And now, we have an opportunity to make Arizona the 16th state in the country to partially count provisional ballots that are cast in the wrong precinct.
John Sherman is a staff attorney with the Fair Elections Legal Network based in Washington, D.C. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, trying to get one population reconnected, and another installment in our series, We Are the Valley. That and more as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by Southwest Shakespeare Company, performing A Christmas Carol through December 20th. Scrooge is once again visited by the spirits of Christmas past, present, and future. Details at swshakespeare.org.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. Stay with us. We've got BBC News Hour coming up for you this afternoon at 1. Around the state right now, 48 degrees and raining in Prescott. It's 66 in Casa Grande and 70 right now in Tucson. If you're looking for more jazz in Phoenix, Jazz PHX is your source for classic jazz and your connection to the Phoenix jazz scene. It's at jazz.kjzz.org and on your HD radio at 91.5 HD2. Are you planning a ski trip? If you have a vehicle that just won't make it to Flagstaff or Park City, why not donate it to KJZZ? You can find out more at cars.kjzz.org. In Valley traffic right now, there's an accident on Grand Avenue. At 83rd Avenue, the road is closed in both directions right now, and there's no word yet on when it will reopen. 65 degrees in Phoenix at 11:13.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Tempe is looking to add to its transit system. Valley Metro has recommended a 3-mile route for a modern streetcar, and on Monday, the agency held a public meeting to get input on the route, where the stop should be, among other things. Joining me now to talk about the project is Tempe Councilwoman Shanna Ellis. She's also on Valley Metro's Board of Directors and the Valley Metro Rail Board of Directors. Also here is Eric Iverson, a project manager with Tempe working on the streetcar project. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So why does Tempe need a streetcar?
Thank you for the question. I would say, Tempe has done a great job in the last 30 years, especially in the last 15 years since we had a successful passage of a transportation tax in 1996, in expanding our options for transportation, all different types of transportation, including our neighborhood circulator routes, the Orbit, strong movement towards building good bicycle and pedestrian facilities, and then, of course, investment in the light rail system and our transit system. The streetcar adds another dimension to that transportation system that circulates people in our urban core, connecting our neighborhoods to the light rail and to our major destination areas.
And I would also like to add, Tempe is landlocked, so we can't grow out. We need to grow up. And this is an economic development tool for our city.
How so?
Well, we have seen the amazing investment with our light rail system. A $1.4 billion investment right now has returned a $7 billion investment. And we know other communities, when they put track down, economic development follows.
So how would this be different than the light rail? You mentioned Tempe is obviously part of the valley that has existing light rail in it. How would a streetcar be different than that?
Yeah, the streetcar, it's a little bit smaller scale than the light rail. If you look at the light rail, it has three cars that make up that train. It's operating on a regional level, connecting many cities. The streetcar is a regional service that connects to that regional other transit options. But it is, again, it's operating in our urban core. It has a little bit smaller stature with the stop locations. It is operating in mixed traffic, so it's sharing vehicle lanes. It is meant to be a little bit matching the character of smaller streets and walkable areas connecting to, again, our neighborhoods as well as to major destinations like ASU and the light rail line.
Would it run on the same or similar kinds of tracks as light rail, or is it a totally separate system?
No, it is meant to be compatible with the regional light rail system. It's the same, basically the same kind of track. There's a little bit different, again, character of the station design. They're smaller, but the track itself is compatible. These vehicles would go back to the same maintenance yard. They're part of the regional system.
I'd also like to mention that the streetcar tracks are not as deep as light rail tracks, so the construction wouldn't be as immense as it has been for light rail. Portland has been able to do 3 blocks in 3 weeks. They, of course, have a different learning curve than we have right now, but, you know, we expect that the construction to be a lot less. There'll be less utilities that need to be moved underground and that type of thing with this.
I wanted to ask you about the construction, because during light rail, there's a lot of talk all over the valley about the disruption to businesses along the route and commuters because streets had to literally be torn up. You mentioned that the streetcar is less than that, but still, I would imagine if you're putting tracks in the ground and you're sharing lanes with traffic, it's going to be some kind of disruption, right?
Yes, and there will be with any kind of construction, but I was able to actually see Portland when they were putting down some tracks, and they actually were able to open some of them at night for cars to be able to drive. The construction was not like light rail, just because, you know, there's just the stops don't need to be raised and set aside. It's more like a bus stop with tracks outside.
Have you heard from businesses who would be along the proposed route, which we'll talk about in just a minute, about how they feel about the costs and benefits of the short-term construction potential disruption versus a longer-term, you have the streetcar running right outside your business?
We have been working very closely, both through the Tempe Chamber of Commerce and through the Downtown Tempe Authority, to work with businesses, and they are very supportive of a streetcar going through the city. And I have seen that change over the years. They were a little bit reluctant at first, but with a lot of education and a lot of the public meetings that we've been having, they're very supportive. And both groups that oversee those businesses have been supportive of it, and the individual businesses have come out to many of our public meetings to show their support.
Do you think that's at least in part due to the fact that those businesses that survived the light rail construction seem to have been doing better, and there's been more development along the light rail line?
I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. Yeah, the light rail being used as an example.
So, Eric, let's talk about the route a little bit. This is mostly, as you both have said, sort of an urban kind of thing. This is basically through downtown Tempe and a little bit around the ASU Tempe campus, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's connecting all those major areas that you mentioned, the Rio Salado and all the redevelopment that's happening along Rio Salado Parkway, Beach Park, and all the regional events and local events that happen there. Obviously, connecting to ASU and the ridership that we have through that campus and connects uniquely to some historic neighborhoods and some of our oldest, most established areas of Tempe. So it will look at connecting to the redevelopment that's happening on Ash Avenue as well, and then all of the new dormitory and multifamily and mixed-use housing that's been being built on Apache Boulevard.
How much of this is about the ASU campus? I mean, it's always one of the, if not the biggest, student bodies in the country, and obviously a big part of what Tempe is and who's there. So I'm curious how much of this project is aimed at moving students around better and making and helping sort of the ASU campus.
I would say that ASU is a great partner in our regional transportation system, and as we know, the downtown Phoenix campus has been growing, and the relationship between the Tempe campus and Phoenix has been supported well through the light rail, the existing light rail. This will help to serve that student population, but again, it's we have a great neighborhoods that are adjacent to the route in Tempe, and we also have some infill and urbanization that's happening in Tempe with new condo developments and new housing opportunities for people living in Tempe to use this as well.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. That's Eric Iverson. He's a project manager with Tempe working on that city streetcar project. Also joined in studio by Tempe City Councilwoman Shanna Ellis. Shanna, there's a pretty hefty price tag associated with this project, around $200 million or so, give or take. A little bit. I know when you're in government, a couple million dollars is sort of pocket change in some cases. But tell me a little bit about where is that money going? What are the big expenses for a project like this?
Well, there are some monies that are already set aside for this specific project. There's some federal money called CMAQ. It stands for Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Funds, $32 million. We also have some money through our regional tax, the Prop 400, about $47 million that's been set aside. We do plan on submitting for a federal grant, a Small Starts grant, for $75 million, and that will be submitted next year. So there is still a little bit of a delta, and we hope that some other funding opportunities do come along. The operation of this streetcar, which we estimate will be between $3.1 and $4 million, will be paid out of Tempe's local transit tax. It's already been budgeted for, and that's a tax that doesn't expire in Tempe.
How confident are you that federal grant will come through? And in the event that it doesn't, are there other places you can look for that money?
Well, we have, there are certain steps that you have to go through in order to even apply for that grant, and we have met all those qualifications, so we do qualify, and we're working very closely with the federal government to make sure that we meet the guidelines in order to apply, but we will have some choices to make after, you know, we find out whether we get the federal grant or not, but like I said, the money is still, there's still some money set aside, so one of the options is to build a portion of the plan, and that would be up to the regional body and to the Tempe City Council to decide whether that happens.
So you'd build sort of a portion of that 3-mile route and figure out the rest later? Is that...
Right, but in order to apply for this Small Starts grant, we can't have put any shovels in the ground yet. So that's tying our hands a little bit right now. So we'll go ahead and apply for the federal monies, and then decisions will have to be made after we get an answer to that grant.
And just to add to that, we've been going through this process with the Federal Transit Administration for quite a while, and they have advanced the project as of last spring of 2013. They advanced the project into project development. Those are good indicators from the FTA of a strong project. And so we're kind of going through their process, and we feel that it's a strong project and that they have given that indication as well.
How closely are you guys watching what's going on in Tucson with its experience with the streetcar that they opened not that long ago?
Yes, we have been watching that very closely, and actually their ridership numbers have exceeded expectations thus far, which is a great indicator for us. But they've also had a lot of economic development activity happening even before the first rider got on the streetcar down there. So that's wonderful news for us too.
So what kind of time frame are we looking at? Obviously there's some paperwork and some grants that still need to come in, and then you need to start construction, and then at some point after that, the project would be done. What sort of time frame are we looking at for those steps?
Well, right now the target date for operations is in 2018. So we would apply for the federal grant next September and hope to hear early 2016, and then we can start construction. It's about a year and a half or 2 years of construction.
For that full 3-mile
Correct.
Line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Shanna Ellis is a city councilwoman in Tempe. She's also on the Valley Metro's Board of Directors and the Valley Metro Rail Board of Directors. We also heard from Eric Iverson. He's a project manager with Tempe working on the streetcar project. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Arizona's economy has generally not come back as quickly as some other states after the Great Recession. So will 2015 be any better than 2014? Economists are offering their best predictions today at the annual Economic Forecast Luncheon, sponsored by the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU and J.P. Morgan Chase. Lee McFeeters, director of the J.P. Morgan Chase Outlook Center at the Carey School of Business, is one of the prognosticators. I spoke with him earlier and asked him how Arizona's economy is doing now.
There's a paradox of sorts in that I think that certainly the analysts I work with, but even business people, general citizens, feel that the economy is not doing very well. But when you look at the actual numbers, compare where Arizona is to the nation as a whole or to the average state, we're actually performing better than the average state. The issue is that compared to our own long-term historical performance, it certainly does not measure up. But I could just give you an example. The
Sure.
U.S. economy is probably going to struggle to add jobs at 2% this year, and we expect that Arizona's growth is going to be a bit better than that, 2.2%, something in that range. In other words, not a huge difference, but just on most indicators, we're doing better than the nation as a whole.
So why do you think there's that disconnect then?
Well, I think that what we have seen primarily in the job market is that even though the U.S. economy lost a lot of jobs, over 8 million jobs, there were headlines in May when they got all the lost jobs back. Finally, it took over 7.5 years, but finally got all the lost jobs back. Whereas here in Arizona, I think it's pretty well known that we've not recovered all the jobs that were lost. According to our tracking numbers, we're at about 69% of the jobs lost have so far been recovered. So that one statistic, I think, really kind of sends a message that there's a gap between Arizona and the U.S.
Do you forecast that Arizona will pick up the job growth a little bit in 2015?
Well, our projection is that, we've seen 3 consecutive years here of about 2% job growth, and our projection for 2015 is really more of the same, a little bit faster, 2.5%. We expect something in the range, maybe finally getting more than 50,000 jobs added a year, probably 60, 65,000 jobs. So slow improvement, which is consistent with what we're seeing on the national level.
What are the other indicators that you look at to say, yes, Arizona's economy will do better in 2015, or we're going to be flat, or maybe we even do a little worse?
There are a couple of indicators I think that most analysts are really focused on for 2015. One of them is population growth. When the Arizona economy is humming, we are adding population at 2.5%, 3%, maybe even 3.5%. The numbers for 2013 was 1.2% growth, and compared to the nation, that's much better. The nation didn't even grow 1%, but population growth has been a disappointment, and we're expecting that migration will pick up, and that will improve a bit to maybe 1.5%, which would really be twice as good as the average state, twice as good as the nation. So population, that's probably the number one indicator to watch. The second is residential construction, particularly the single-family component. Analysts were really surprised to see that single-family permits did not grow in 2014. We're actually expecting to be down about something in the range of maybe 5 to 6% compared to a year ago, which is absolutely going in the wrong direction.
During the recession, there was a lot of talk about the need for Arizona to diversify its economy a little bit and not just depend on things like population growth and construction, be it housing or commercial. Has Arizona diversified itself, or are we still relying on the same kinds of industries that we've always relied on?
Well, in this recovery, there's actually been some real pleasant surprises. I think that we'll end the year 2014 ranked among all states. We'll certainly be in the top 5 states for growth in finance and insurance jobs. Those are very solid jobs, and I think that we've been able to compete here in Arizona with quality of labor, with on a cost competitive basis, office space is available. So finance and insurance, very strong part of the economy. Healthcare, completely recession resistant, continued to grow through the downturn, and we're going to end the year, I think, as probably the number 2 or 3 state in the country for the rate of growth of new healthcare jobs. So two parts of the economy that, a few years ago were just sort of middle of the pack have really come on very strong. Of course, there's always the service-related jobs, retail trade, food service, and so forth. And those jobs are growing in proportion to population. I think the real disappointment is manufacturing. We're probably going to end the year losing manufacturing jobs. And the big surprise is that we're probably going to have fewer construction jobs this year. When we do the final annual tally, we'll have fewer construction jobs than we did a year ago. And usually this is a part of the economy that in a recovery can be growing 8 or 10%.
Lee McFeeters with the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
And still to come, our series We Are the Valley looks into a community of people supporting each other and trying to re-engage a population of younger people. That's ahead as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo on behalf of the Sonoran Desert Chorale, presenting Rejoice and Sing with brass and audience sing-along this Saturday and Sunday. Video and info at sonorandesertchorale.org.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Well, it should be a mostly cloudy day in the valley today. A slight chance of some showers and a high of 75 degrees. More clouds tomorrow for your Thursday and a high of 72. The sun will peak out just a little bit on Friday and will reach 76 degrees. One note in valley traffic to pass along to you right now. Grand Avenue is closed in both directions due to a crash at 83rd Avenue. Stay with us at 12 o'clock for Here and Now from Boston. Heavy rains in California are spurring fears of floods and mudslides. And we'll hear about the Beer Mile World Championships, where runners compete to see who can drink four beers and run a mile the fastest. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon. Cloudy skies, 52% relative humidity, and it's 66 degrees in Phoenix at 11:32.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. KJZZ is exploring what it means to be part of a community in a series called We Are the Valley. Today, we're discussing a lesser-known 12-step recovery group. Al-Anon is made up of people who have friends or family who've been affected by alcoholism. Steve talked with two members of Al-Anon who are also involved in service, which means they volunteer with the organization. Because of the anonymous nature of the group, the two people with whom Steve talked asked to use the pseudonyms Matt and Anna. For those not familiar with the group, Anna begins by explaining the nature of the program.
We tend to try and to hide the secret, make everything look okay, try and make the person better, because we have this sense that we should be able to solve the problem. And so the program is about us getting together, working the 12 steps that actually came from Alcoholics Anonymous. But we have found, and the founders found, that by working the steps ourselves, we start to be able to live a serene life even when the chaos is still going around.
Anna, when you're talking about trying to solve the problem or take care of the issue, does that make it more difficult, less likely for you to want to reach out to a group? Are you thinking that you're experiencing this problem and maybe nobody else is? Did you ever have that kind of thought? I mean, are you that ingrained with what's going on in your own life?
That is absolutely part of the problem for us, is that we think that we're unique. We think that we should be able to solve it. And so what tends to happen is that we start to really withdraw. We don't want people to know what's going on because we think somehow we've failed in not solving the problem. So, you know, first maybe we withdraw from friends so that they don't see the problem. Then we start withdrawing from family because sometimes people have opinions about what we should or shouldn't be doing. And then eventually it's basically us, the person who has the problem with the alcohol, and, you know, it becomes this lonely world.
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. That idea of withdrawing or just having a very limited group of people that we feel like we can share with. And we live in this world of secrets. We think that these secrets are just so horrible that we can't share them with anybody. And when I came to Al-Anon, you know, that was really the first time in my life that I had found anybody that I could really talk to about this important issue in my life. And I had this amazing experience. I found that the more I shared, and it was very difficult to start with, but I'm sitting in a room with other people that are sharing their stories, and there's a lot of pain in those stories. But I found that as I shared my story, every time I did that, I walked away feeling a little lighter and a little better. And that secret that had seemed so horrible and that seemed to really weigh me down, it was like it evaporated, you know, just by that act of sharing it.
What made you finally decide that you needed to be in a group where maybe folks like that could help you improve your situation?
Well, I have a spouse that had an alcohol problem or has an alcohol problem, and the rehabilitation center recommended that I attend a couple of Al-Anon meetings. And at that point in time, I had no idea what Al-Anon was, but I think it was something that if I hadn't reached a point in my life where I was just desperate to try something, I probably still wouldn't have gone. You know, the possibility of going to maybe a therapist, you know, had come up. And it was just something I just rejected that option. You know, it seemed like, again, like that was too personal.
Did you have any expectations going in that this would end up being something where it would resemble a community, where it really felt like not just people have the same experience, but that people can really, I mean, did the light go on? Where you really felt like, wow, this is, I didn't expect this, and now I'm really feeling like this was the right step.
Not immediately at all. It was just a place I went, you know, an hour a night, once or twice a week. And for maybe the first year or 2 years, it was just, that was all I did. And we talk a lot about keeping the focus on ourselves, and it almost seemed kind of like a self-help group or a support group. And then at some point in time, I reached this point where I started to experience this larger community of other Al-Anon members across the valley and across the state. And as I've started to get to know those people, it has become, it's very much like a family. It feels like coming home, you know. I walk into a room full of people that say, hi, how are you? And I know that they know something about me and they care about me and they love me.
Anna, how has it been a community experience for you?
Well, very much similar to how Matt described it. Although I had, coming into the program, I had that immediate sense of, you know, this is absolutely the place I need to be. There was no question for me. It was the first time in my life that I'd ever had that shared experience. But I wouldn't go to say that I went, oh yeah, and these people are going to become a part of my everyday life. It was like, finally, after, you know, trying counseling and all these different things, this felt very different. And I was going to keep coming and trying that. I actually moved from another place down to Phoenix. And one of the reasons I was able to make that move was because I went, you know, I'm going to be okay because Al-Anon is everywhere. I get to carry my family, you know, with me. I actually travel a lot in my work, and I can go and get that same sense of community. People will offer to pick me up and take me to the meeting. People will offer to, you know, come have dinner in our home. You're traveling, you know, come to have dinner. And because we have this shared sense of hope, this shared foundation, we can all connect. And as Matt was saying, I do things outside of meetings. Go camping, we do this Christmas ornament thing, we go for barbecues, and to be able to walk into a room and feel, you know, loved and cared about, regardless of what else is happening in my life, is a very unique experience and so welcome. When these days it's easy to be alone.
When we start to feel a sense of community in any aspect of our lives, there is that sort of letting down the guard. Matt, were you at a point where you felt like if I don't let down the guard and I don't find people with the ability to do that with me in the same sort of communal way, then this problem, this issue can't be dealt with? I mean, had you reached a stage where you were just willing to try anything?
I had reached a stage where I was willing to try something different. You know, I went through a lot and went through it for a lot of years and thought I kind of had it under control. And it wasn't until later, until I'd been in the groups for a while, that I started to realize how not in control I actually was. Mm-hmm. You know, how out of control and how chaotic my life actually was. But I thought I was kind of holding it together.
Anna, you know, a lot of, to make it a little broader, a lot of us in life, whether it's something minor or something major, we all kind of want to be understood, whether it's by someone we love or just someone we work with or something like that. So I guess when we get into this idea that people have had a common experience, how difficult is it, though, to trust even at that point that what you're hearing is reality? Like, because it almost seems like it would be stunning to join a group and then have people say things that are so familiar to you and think, especially coming from that perspective of really not knowing if anyone else has that feeling. So I guess I wonder, can you talk a little bit about that, how you were able to develop this idea that not just that it sounded like Al-Anon would work for you, but that it really, in a concrete way, this was going to be this great experience for you?
Okay. Well, I guess I'd like to start just a little bit on why it was different. I was actually, as I mentioned, I was in kind of a lot of crisis in my life, which I was a big driver of because I grew up in the disease, and so I had certain behaviors that weren't helpful in my life. So I actually was seeing a counselor and had been seeing a counselor for a number of years, and she made the suggestion to me, you know, you need some support outside the people who are involved in the crisis of your life. And so that was actually what had me looking around and brought me into the rooms. So I think that the difference in what I heard, having been, you know, tried lots of things, what I heard was, I heard people who had different specific experiences but shared their feelings about those experiences, shared the sense of hopelessness, shared the sense of, I don't know what to do. I don't believe this can be any different. And then started to share how their experiences of that day or that week, where they were really, you know, having friends and they were able to be productive at work and they were able to be calm in the middle of situations which I knew I would have been hysterical about at that point. And I think one of the biggest things for me was coming in and hearing people laugh. And not just about things that I might have maybe been able to laugh about at that point, but they were able to laugh about situations which you wouldn't normally laugh at, right? Because there was just this sense that people weren't alone and there were other people in that room who could share the laughter, but in a loving and caring way. And I think that kind of comes back to what you were talking about, right? Is that here, these people could be 100% themselves and mess up as human beings do on a daily basis, right? Talk about that, laugh about it, have other people laugh because they were like, oh, yeah, it was only yesterday I was doing the same thing, right? And then you're like, okay, right? We are all here together, which is, now I have huge respect for therapy and counseling and all of that. But it is very different to have someone talking to you about what could change, what needs to change, with care and thought and all of that, versus when it's coming from, I just did this. I took these steps, I took these actions, and now this is different. It's just a very different experience. So,
right along those same lines, you know, I walked into those rooms and went through a lot of changes. You know, I really could feel myself changing and growing. But, you know, to some extent, you don't see your own changes. You know, what I did see was I saw other people that came in the rooms just about the same time that I did, and watching them grow and blossom. And it's just, you know, it's just so amazing to see that. And that's part of what convinced me that this could be good for me, too, is just, you know, I have to believe it because I've seen it in other people. You know, even if I don't believe that I'm better, and sometimes I don't, you know, sometimes I still have a lot of issues and scary things going on, but I watch other people improve, and I'm like, yeah, I can do that too.
Well, one of the challenges in putting together this particular conversation for We Are the Valley was that to find people in Al-Anon who were willing to talk about their experience. So how is it that you two decided it was comfortable talking about it or willing to talk about it?
Well, I mean, one of the things about our program is that it is an anonymous program. But in saying that, that means that it is designed to make sure that people feel comfortable coming in, as you were talking about earlier, being able to share openly and know that what is said in the inside the rooms never leaves the rooms. So somebody can come in, have a conversation. You know, if you're in a small town, it means you're very likely to meet and know those other folks, right? Your comments are safe. Because we talk about things that are pretty personal in the rooms, that those are safe. But the program itself is not anonymous. The program, you know, we're trying actually to work more with the professional community, get people aware and, research done so that people can understand we're not some secret society. We don't want to be a secret society. We just want people to know that when they're here, what they say is very confidential.
You're both married.
Yes.
And I sort of think sometimes when my wife and I don't have kids, so I almost feel like when we're at home by ourselves with our cats, it's almost like our own little community. But when you're, regardless of whether things that you're working out with Alan are things within yourselves, I'm really curious as to how, when there's that community you might have at home, there's the Al-Anon community, how do your spouses feel about that? How do they feel about, you know, sharing secrets in this community sense? Is that anything you could address? I'm kind of interested in that.
Well, I want to keep the focus on myself a little bit. And what I really want to say is that, yeah, my wife and I have a little community at the house with ourselves and our two dogs. But what I recognized, you know, at some point in time in the fairly recent past was that I need more than just that relationship, you know, that one person can't do everything for me. And I get a lot out of this organization, this other organization I belong to, you know, Al-Anon, and I get so much out of it, and it's so good for me that that I make that a part of my life. My wife, you know, absolutely appreciates what Al-Anon's done for me. It's totally improved our relationship with each other. You know, it's improved my relationship with my coworkers. It's to improve my relationship with my fellow drivers on the freeway and et cetera. You know, I really apply a lot of this stuff to all parts of my life, but it is really a part of my life that is just incredibly important for me.
If you're part of a community around town, tell us about it for our We Are the Valley series. Just send us a note, wearethevalley@kjzz.org. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. The Phoenix area has one of the highest rates of so-called disconnected youth in the country. Those are 16 to 24-year-olds who are neither working nor in school. The Project Measure of America has been looking at this population, and in a report says as of 2010, there were nearly 6 million disconnected youths, about 1 in 7 Americans between those ages. That report also says 17.3% of 16 to 24-year-olds in the Phoenix area are disconnected. Only 3 of the largest metro areas in the country had higher rates. That's led to efforts in the Valley to try to bring that number down. One of the people behind those efforts is Don Covey, Maricopa County Superintendent of Schools, and he joins me now. Don, welcome.
Good morning, Mark.
So how big of a problem do you see this being?
Well, it's huge. You already stated very well that nationally it's 1 in 7 young people between the ages 16 and 24 who are disconnected. In the metropolitan area of Phoenix, it's 1 in 5. In certain locales by zip code, it can be as low as 1 in 3, and that's our focus, and they're actually called Promise Zones, which is a national program in terms of saying is, how do you move this population away from being disconnected to reconnect them with a lot of the opportunities they unfortunately did missed when they were younger people?
So your agency has been involved in a couple of summits dealing with this. You have another one coming up in a few months. What kinds of strategies are you trying to come up with to try to bring the number down and get these 16 to 24-year-olds either back to school or in some kind of career?
Our first summit back in May of the past year, we had an awareness. People were, this is like a big white elephant in the valley. Nobody really sees it. I mean, can you see a young person? They don't have a barcode on their head that said, I am disconnected. So our first summit dealt with just, are you aware of this elephant in the valley? And they said, wow. And we had about 300 people there from different agencies, both public, private, and citizens as well. And so that awareness really helped us move to the next October, the most recent summit, Summit 2. We said, we just can't be talking about the problem. We have to do something with it. So our research division started looking at across the country. They came around, they came about with three different organizations, cities as a matter of fact. Philadelphia, who have been working on disconnected youth for the last decade. And what's significant, they serve about 85,000 young people a year in this population, and they made great gains of getting them associated again. And then Boston. Boston's another great example. Los Angeles City and city schools have been really another good ally. So we've somewhat collaborated very closely with these individuals, saying is, what has to be different? So they said, well, you need to develop what we call as a paradigm, a design of kind of a blueprint. And they discovered our success had been one of the following four things. They're called pathways. First pathway has to do with re-engagement centers. These are centers that, like, if you and I were disconnected, we start finding out where the location of these places are, and they can help us. They help a young person saying is, what is it you can do, and what's it take to do that? So they can kind of start setting some goals in their mind, and they have revelations of saying is, I had no idea I had that talent or ability. The second pathway has to do with educational momentum. The educational system they were in, they disengaged from, you can't recreate that. Then the third pathway we use has to do with career pathways. What does that real career look like? Then finally, the one that really makes a big difference, they call is youth, positive youth development. There's a lot of psychological. Unfortunately, these young people made bad mistakes. They can be addicted to drugs, alcohol, and taking the wrong path. So they got to start rewiring their brain cells a little bit and saying, I can positive. I can do this now. I couldn't do before, but I believe in myself.
Well, you referenced that this is a population that's not sort of out there, that you kind of have to know to be looking for. And as you referenced, these are people who have sort of disengaged from school or from a career. So, A, how do you get to them? And B, how do you convince them that, hey, this is something that you should be looking at, maybe going back to get a GED, or here's a career that you could pursue?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing is we can advertise. This population is very astute. So once you can give them excitement about how they can really become more connected in their life or what have you, you're going to have to change the word, though, later on. Nobody likes to be disconnected. But they say, hey, you can be an opportunity. So this opportunity is that we can prevail on it. Here's the key. Once you have a certain number of these young people together, they market and sell each other. They are the best salespeople with their peers, saying, hey, these people are legitimate. They really do care, and they can make a difference to it. Plus the fact you have to have caring adults who also believe these young people are not dumb stupid. They're very bright. They have the same capacity in their brain. It's providing them those opportunities for them to succeed.
How much of fixing this problem can and should be done through government, and how much of it has to be done through nonprofits or other kinds of resources?
All of the above. All of the above. I think initially I represent government as a county, and I think there has to be somebody who initiates, who starts the momentum moving. But as I said earlier, when all of our summits have a representation from private and public sector, because it takes a combination of both. The sooner we can move away from being codependent on public services and get me more to the private, that's the investment. But private investment won't get there unless you can show from the public resources, like public schools, have a young person capable of doing a job. Once you see that, they start kicking in. So there's a combination of public and private. It's a harmony of both, but it shouldn't certainly not be totally public, because if they're codependent on government, they won't go anywhere.
What's a realistic goal as far as bringing the number down? I mean, do you want to bring it to zero? Is that a realistic goal?
I'm going to take the lead from Measures of America. If we collaboratively can come together, private and public, really know what we're faced with, and we say I have a population, I'll reduce it very conservative, 100,000. In 5 years, if we reduce that by 50%, by utilizing these pathways and these incentives and these collaborations we'd have, that'd be humongous. I didn't even talk about what it cost with this population. You're into the social cost right now. If you put it all together, about $127 billion over 4 years. That's huge. We can't afford to do that. We wanted to convert them from being, if you will, kind of the dependent on the social service public side to becoming taxpayers. That sounds really self-serving. But that's how we generate the support services of opportunities. So a 50% reduction over 5 years. We can't say we're going to start now and in 10 years come back and check with us. Americans don't wait that long. We have actually no delayed gratification. We got to get it now.
Don Covey is Maricopa County Superintendent of Schools. Don, thanks.
You're more than welcome.
It's not just governments and nonprofits working to address this issue. The arts are also taking a crack at it. This weekend, Rising Youth Theater will perform the world premiere of the play Disengaged by Tucson playwright Milta Ortiz. To talk more about the show, I'm joined by Xanthia Walker, one of the co-founders of Rising Youth Theater, and high school student Alyssa Baeza, who's working on the play as assistant stage manager. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Xanthia, this play looks at the issue of disengaged youth, disconnected youth, by talking to current high school students. So how did this all come about?
Well, Mayor Stanton's office released a report in last spring about the dropout crisis in Arizona, and specifically in Phoenix. And as a theater company that is really interested in issues in our community that impact youth, we said, well, of course, we want to do a play about that.
So what did the students have to say?
You know, we went through a process with a bunch of different community partners. We worked really closely with Genesis Academy, where Alyssa is actually a student. And we heard a really wide array of stories. But the most common thing I think that we heard was that a lot of youth leave school because they feel like it is not the place for them. They're not supported, or it's not where they belong, or it's not where they are getting positive reinforcement or resources. And so they leave because they feel like it's not their space.
Alyssa, is this an issue that you and your peers and your classmates talk about?
Yes, it is. It's because we have a lot of hard trouble. And what people don't understand is that with every economy that keeps going and every generation, it gets harder and harder. But people, the youth does not feel like that they belong in the school and they're not getting the educational help that they need. So they just go down the wrong path and they just don't want to come to school, which I think is a really, really big problem.
When you say that they think that school is not really, they're not getting the education they need, it's not teaching them what they need to know, or they just don't need what school is offering them right now?
What they don't understand is that it is about the learning, and some teachers don't care or provide the necessary services that they need to help improve their skills and get them through life. But it is also about where they don't care or they don't feel like they need it in life. They don't need education, but it'll take you a long way in improving your life and getting you a job, a house, and all of that. And throughout the school years, it does get harder, and we learn that. But if you don't understand the work and the teacher just push you forward, you don't understand it and you don't get set in the right direction you need. You just fall behind. And they blame that on the students, but it's also the students, the teachers, the staff, and their family who needs to help them boost the level up and get to that level where they need to be at.
Xanthia, tell us a little bit about the play, and I'm curious about how you perform a show like this without being kind of preachy about it.
Oh, that's absolutely a consideration. We're really focused on starting a conversation. The play is not about answers, and it's not about talking about what we should do to end the dropout crisis. What we were really interested in is, what is the youth perspective? What do young people have to say about this? I think we talk around youth issues a lot as adults in the world, and it's sort of rare that we actually ask young people what they think and what their actual experience is. So that's what we wanted to do with this. We wanted to bring youth voices and youth stories into the conversation, and we mediate that through art. But our play doesn't provide solutions. It's supposed to start us in a direction of a dialogue in our community.
Alyssa, how close to real life, or how accurate do you find the play?
It's really, really close to real life. It's because it's right on, not pinpoints, exactly how we feel and how we feel when we're in school and adults, and it's not just how we are in school, but how we go home with it and how all the pressure comes down on us at home and we have to go through life like this, and it's nobody understands, but it's exactly the way we live our life, and it's going to get worse and worse if we don't do something about it.
Now, Alyssa, you are someone who describes herself as having to re-engage. So I'm curious, what was the process like of becoming disengaged and then sort of getting back on track?
For me personally, if I could allow that, I felt like I wasn't learning right. I know the stuff, I know the material, I wasn't getting extra credit to help. I used to help students out, and they never understood because the teacher never taught right. But my perspective is that that we, as a student body, we don't understand. But if you have students, and like I got disengaged, I never dropped out, but I felt like I was to that point of where I wanted to drop out. And once I learned that, I found a school that actually helps provide you with services after school and help you actually learn the criteria that you need to graduate, I felt that I know where I belong.
Alyssa Baez is working on the play Disengaged as assistant stage manager. We also heard from Xanthia Walker, co-founder of Rising Youth Theater. Disengaged performing this weekend at Phoenix Center for the Arts. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
That's it for today. If you missed any part of today's Here and Now, you'll be able to listen to individual segments this afternoon at kjzz.org. Thanks to Sarah Ventry, Jimmy Jenkins, and Bruce Drummond for their help. Steve is back next week. I'm Mark Brody. Thank you for listening. NPR's Here and Now from Boston is next on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. It's 12 noon.